Tonight, we are so very fortunate to have the neuroscientist, Dr. Eric Kandel, with us to share his book, The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind and Brain, from Vienna 1900 to the Present, which since its publication in 2012 has met with abundant critical acclaim, winning the Kresge Award, which is Austria's highest literary honor. Born in Vienna, Dr. Kandel writes in his preface, which is as far as I've gotten, but tonight is the beginning of me reading this beautiful book. But in the preface, I was immediately taken with its author. He says, having been born in Vienna, Dr. Kandel writes, I was forced to leave Vienna as a child, but the intellectual life of the turn of the century Vienna is in my blood. My heart still beats in three-quarter time. Dr. Kandel, referred to as the rock star of neuroscience, is a graduate of Harvard College and NYU School of Medicine. He trained in neurobiology at the National Institute of Health and in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He joined the faculty of the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University in 1974 as the founding director of the Center of Neurobiology and Behavior, and he organized Columbia's neuroscience curriculum. He is the director of the Kavli Institute for Brain Science, the co-director of the Mortimer B. Zuckerman Mind-Brain Behavior Institute, and senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He has received over 23 honorary degrees. and he is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, as well as the National Science Academies of Austria, of France, Germany, and Greece. He has been recognized with the Albert Lasker Award and the Heineken Award of the Netherlands and the Gunnar Award of Canada, the Harvey Prize and the Wolf Prize of Israel, the National Medal of Science USA, and the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine, which was in 2000. And I can't believe it's taken me this long into the introduction to mention that he's a Nobel Prize winner. But I don't think I'm telling any of you anything new. Dr. Kandel is an editor of Principles of Neuroscience, which is the standard textbook in the field. And he reached a really broad and general audience with his 2006 book, In Search of Memory, The Emergence of the New Science of the Mind, as well as through the Charlie Rose Brain series on PBS that I think some of you may be familiar with. His latest book, Reductionism in Art and Brain Science, expands on his interest in art and science as he shows how a radically reductionist approach applied to the most complex puzzle of our time, the brain, has been employed by modern artists who distill their subjective world into color, form, and light. And then, of course, the subject of tonight's lecture, the Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain, from Vienna 1900 to the Present, in which Dr. Kandel takes on what he has explained as the central challenge of science in the 21st century, to understand the human mind in biological terms, by focusing on how the new science of the mind has begun to engage with art. So our good fortune tonight could not be overstated. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Eric Kandel.
Thank you, Terry, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you for bringing me to Fort Worth. Had I realized what a magnificent town this was, I would have come on my own earlier. You really are very fortunate to live here. And this museum, it's worth the price of admission. As Terry pointed out for you, the central challenge of science in the 21st century is to understand the human mind in biological terms. The possibility of meeting that challenge opened up in the late 20th century, when cognitive psychology,
the science of the mind, merged with neuroscience, the science of the brain. The result was a new biological science of mind that allowed us to address a range of problems about ourselves. How do we perceive, learn, and remember? What is the nature of emotion, empathy, and consciousness? This new biological science of mind is important not only because it provides a deeper understanding of what makes us who we are, but also because it makes possible a meaningful series of dialogues between brain science and other areas of knowledge. In a larger sense, these dialogues could help make science part of our common cultural experience. I would like to take up this scientific challenge tonight by focusing on how the new biological science of mind has begun to engage with figurative art. In my life as a scientist, I have often benefited from taking a reductionist approach. I try to explore a large problem that interests me. In my case, this is the problem of memory storage, by initially focusing on its simplest example and trying to explore it deeply. I will also do so here tonight. I will limit my discussion to one particular art form, portraiture, in one particular cultural period, modernism in Vienna 1900. I focus on portraiture because it is a highly suitable art form for scientific exploration. We're now at the beginning of an intellectually satisfying understanding of how we respond to facial expressions and bodily postures of others. I focus on portraiture in the period Vienna 1900 because this artistic school of painters can be explored in depth. There are only three major artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele, yet the school is important in the history of art both collectively and individually. As a group, they sought to depict the unconscious intellectual strivings of people in their portraiture, yet each artist developed a distinctive way of using facial expressions and hand and body gestures to communicate his insight. In so doing, each artist made independent conceptual and technical contributions to modern art. Moreover, the concern of these artists with the truth lying beneath the surface appearance of their subjects was paralleled and influenced by similar concerns with unconscious mental processes in contemporaneous scientific medicine and psychoanalysis. Thus, the portraiture of the modernists in Vienna 1900 also represents an ideal example of how artistic, psychological, and scientific insights can enrich one another. Let me begin by putting Viennese modernism into a bit of a perspective for you. Modernist thought began in the middle 19th century in part as a response to the restrictions and hypocrisies of everyday life, but even more as a reaction to the Enlightenment of the 18th century and successive emphasis on the rationality of human behavior. The Enlightenment, or Age of Reason, was characterized by the belief that humans were specially created by God as rational creatures that differed from other living creatures by having their actions guided by reason. These Enlightenment beliefs were inspired by the extraordinary success of the scientific revolution of the 16th and 17th century. It was argued that the success of this revolution derived from the application of reason thinking to the study of the universe by rational minds such as those of Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, and Newton. The remarkable achievements of the scientific revolution were celebrated in 1660 by formation of the Royal Society of London, of which Newton became president in 1703. The founders of the society thought of God as a mathematician who designed the universe to operate according to logical mathematical principles. I shall point out to you, in case you're not familiar, this is not the Jewish definition of God. The function of the scientist was to decipher the code book God had used to create the universe. This perspective led to the belief that we live in a rational world in which reason and enlightened thought will ultimately lead to a better condition for all humankind. In reacting to the Enlightenment, modernism represented a search for a new worldview, a view partially provided by Charles Darwin. Darwin argued that humans are not uniquely created, but are biological creatures that have evolved from simple animal ancestors. That evolution is driven by sexual selection, so that from an evolutionary perspective, the primary function of a biological organism is to reproduce itself. Since sexual attraction and mate selection are central to the behavior of all animals, sex must be central to human behavior. This is half a century before Freud. A key to sexual attraction, mate selection, and indeed to all social interactions, is facial expressions and the emotion it mediates. Mechanism had many roots. The Viennese form of modernism, the Age of Insight, had three main features which still characterize the world we live in today. A new view of the human mind as not being rational, but driven by unconscious sexual and aggressive drives. The conviction that the search for the rules that govern the nature of the human mind begins with an examination of oneself. And a broad attempt to integrate and unify knowledge, an attempt driven by science. One example of this attempt at integration was the initiation of a dialogue between art and science. This dialogue had three phases. The independent discovery in Vienna of different aspects of unconscious mental processes by two physicians, Freud and Schnitzler. I'm only going to speak about Freud. And three modernist artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele, all of whom, I will argue, were influenced by a common source, Karl von Okatansky, head of the Vienna School of Medicine. Two, the attempt to bridge art to science, the science being psychology, by three Viennese art historians, not very well known in the United States, Alois Riegel, Ernst Chris, and Ernst Gombrich, through a focus on the beholder's share. And finally, a further bridging of art to science through a biological analysis of the beholder's share, an analysis that is just beginning, continues to this day, the first steps of which were taken in the 1950s, but the visual physiologist Stephen Kufleman knew very well, originally of the Vienna School of Medicine. Three phases of the dialogue relating art and brain science operating in Vienna 1900. The first phase is medical science and art. Until the beginning of the 18th century, hard to believe, medicine was in large part pre-scientific. The first steps toward my modern empirically based medicine were taken in the aftermath of the French Revolution, 1800, and started in Paris with innovations initiated by the revolution in both the hospital system and the university system. But 1840, because of the conservatism of the July monarchy, less support for science at the university, the momentum for creativity in medicine began to decline. The focus now shifted from Paris to Vienna, its university, its medical school, and its hospital, the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus. It began with Maria Theresia, the Queen of Austria, who realized that if you're going to have a strong army, you've got to have a healthy army. You've got to have good physicians taking care of the soldiers in the army. And she invited Gerd from Sweden, from Norway, physician, to come and try to improve health care, both as a personal physician and as a physician for the army, and in fact as a physician for Austria. As a result of Sweden's influence, his predecessor was able to establish a general hospital, Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus, in 1784. This was the most unique hospital in all of Europe. Why was it unique? First of all, this hospital was a university hospital. It belonged to the University of Vienna Medical School, so it had the high standards of an academic institution. Moreover, the University of Vienna Medical School belonged to the University of Vienna, so the medical school had high standards. So these extraordinary high academic standards applied to what was going on in Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus. In addition to these high standards, there were several special features. Every single patient who died in Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus was autopsied. This was unheard of in Europe. Moreover, every single person was autopsied by the same physician, by the head of pathology. Karl von Okatansky, who became head of pathology and ultimately head of the Vienna School of Medicine in 1844, did 60,000 autopsies, an extraordinary number. Now, those of you who are worried, let me assure you, he didn't do them all with his own little hands. He had assistants, but he participated in the important ones. Okatansky firmly believed that we know nothing in medicine. We can't make an intelligent diagnosis. Why is that so? Well, we have a stethoscope, we can listen to the heart, we can listen to the chest, but we didn't have the foggiest notion what the sounds meant. If we had an abnormal sound coming from the heart, we didn't know, was this mitral insufficiency? Was it aortic stenosis? We had no idea what it meant. If you heard peculiar sounds in the chest, Was it pneumonia? Was it pleurisy? What exactly was going on? So Rokitansky decided that the only way we can figure out what's going on is to have a detailed history and physical taking of the patient at the bedside. And if the patient dies, to do an autopsy and correlate the clinical findings at the bedside with what we see at autopsy. So he was fortunate enough to collaborate with Josef Skoda, and Skoda was outstanding internist, did a very good history, very good physical. When the patient died, he and Rokitansky together examined the patient, and as a result, they were able to begin to place medicine on a scientific basis. So Rokitansky's contribution was he provided the basis of modern scientific medicine, the medicine that's practiced right now, right here, even in Texas, provided the basis of modern clinical medicine through systematic clinical pathological correlations. He emphasized the principle, it's really a metaphor, that truth is often hidden below the surface. That's why you do the autopsy. You really find what's going on. This is a metaphor that Freud picked up. And he trained great academic leaders in medicine, including Josef Breuer and Sigmund Freud. Let me just say about his impact on Freud. His impact on Freud was enormous. Freud initially wanted to be an academic scientist, and he wanted to do research. And there was a rule at the University of Vienna that everyone who did research at the university had to give 2 seminars a year, and Rokitansky had to be present for the seminars and had to grade him. Freud gave 2 seminars for Rokitansky, and Rokitansky liked them a great deal. When Rokitansky died, Freud went to the funeral and wrote to friends, "What an enormous loss this is to me personally and to the scientific community." When Freud died, several of the obituaries said, "Isn't it fortunate that he trained with Rokitansky, because psychoanalysis is such a speculative science. Imagine where it would have gone if he hadn't trained with Rokitansky." It isn't commonly appreciated, but Freud started off as a biologist. He was an extremely good biologist. He wrote a very important book on aphasia. He studied the nervous system of fish and invertebrate animals. And I'm particularly fond of his anatomy because he was the first one to show that the nerve cells of simple invertebrate animals are absolutely homologous to nerve cells in your brain. And so he made it clear that studies in invertebrate animals from a physiological and behavioral point of view had relevance to that of higher forms. He wanted to do basic science, but in those days, in order to do basic science, you had to have a private income. He didn't have a private income. He wanted to get married, wanted to have children, so realized he had to go to private practice. He first thought he would go into neurology, but there were so many neurologists in Vienna, he turned to psychiatry. And one of the things that drew him to psychiatry was his friendship with Josef Breuer, who was a neurologist who practiced a great deal of psychiatry. And Breuer was at that point working with a patient called Anna O, very famous case. Anna O presented with a hysterical paralysis of her right arm. Breuer examined her. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her neurologically. This was clearly a hysterical paralysis. And he began to practice hypnosis on her, which was the general treatment for hysteria. And he found that in addition to hypnosis, she would talk to him about certain things that happened. And in the course of doing this, her paralysis resolved. What was the issue? The issue was that her father, when he was ill, liked to sleep on her arm. And when he was doing this, she had both positive and negative thoughts about that. She began to feel very guilty about the negative thoughts. And he ultimately died in this position. And she developed this hysterical paralysis. As she talked about it, this began to resolve. Freud thought this was spectacular. He himself took a little course in hypnosis, began to open up a practice, and realized he didn't need hypnosis. The important thing is what Breuer did, to speak to the patient, have the patient speak to him, free associations. So Freud became really quite good at this. And then he thought, around 1895, that he's going to try to put this on a biological basis, since after all, he was a biologist. And he wrote a paper in 1895 called Psychoanalysis for the Neurologist. Has anyone in the audience read this paper? Please raise your hand. Don't bother to read it. It's incomprehensible. I spent an enormous amount of time trying to understand it, and you just can't make any progress. And that's because, and he realized this, he never published it. It was published after his death by Ernst Chris. He realized that we were nowhere near to having the kind of understanding in biology of the brain necessary to explain psychoanalytic phenomenon. We're not quite there even now, but certainly we're not there in 1895. So he realized what he has to do is not base his clinical experience on biology, but to develop an independent, separate system, a cognitive psychology. This is the first cognitive psychology of the mind. He took the observable behavior, patient symptoms, and normal behavior, and developed an abstract model of the human mind with both conscious and unconscious components, and the brain mechanisms that regulate them, repression, denial, distortion, etc. And he found this very useful in his clinical practice, and he said someday biology will come along and falsify some of these ideas. Now, to try to summarize Freud's scientific contributions in three key ideas is a little bit absurd, but that has not stopped me in the past. I'm going to do it now. He said, Freud said human beings are not rational creatures. They're driven by irrational, unconscious mental processes. Nietzsche had said this before him, so this was not completely original, but he went on to say that adult character, including unconscious sexuality and aggression, can be traced to the mind of the child. This is completely original. And even more striking, he said, no mental event occurs by chance. There's no noise in a machine. Mental events adhere to scientific laws and they follow the principles of psychic determinism. And the whole idea of free association is these ideas are linked to one another, and understanding the sequence of them gives you insight in what they mean. As a result of his contribution, Freud has emerged as a major source of a modern Rokitansky inclination to look for meaning beneath the surface of behavior. However, there were certain important aspects of the human psyche that Freud failed to notice that other Viennese modernists did. He knew very little about female sexuality. Part of the reason is that he'd never been to Texas. But part of it is he had very limited sexual experience. There's a discussion in the literature whether he had ever slept with two women or only with one. But Gustav Klimt, who slept with several hundred women, knew an enormous amount about sexuality. Gustav Klimt learned from Rodin that you don't have models assume artificial poses. So Klimt told his models, as Rodin had said, don't pose for me. Just relax, hang around, do whatever you want. When I find an interesting pose, I'll draw you. And this being Vienna, the girls began to relax. Some of them began to masturbate. Others began to couple with men that came to visit. Others coupled with each other. So he saw a lot of sexual experiences, and he saw how much women enjoy these sexual experiences. So he would draw these, and you see this in his drawing, in the most elegant, delicate, non-pornographic way to show the richness of female sexuality. So he really achieved a post-Darwinian breakthrough in the liberation of female sexuality. You can only appreciate what an advance this was if you look at the depiction of the female in Western art. First of all, if you look at them, they're all mythological women. Venus, Maya, Olympia. It's not the girl next door. Number one. Number two, they all face the viewer as if their only job in the world was to satisfy the sexual curiosity of the male observer. And finally, in three out of the four cases, the woman is using her left hand to cover her pubic area. Now, you don't know, is she being modest or is she masturbating? With Klimt, there's never a moment's hesitation. You know immediately what's going on. But what's even more remarkable, which I think is Klimt's greatest painting, is that he knew that women, like men, not only have great erotic drives, but they also have aggressive drives, and they confuse eroticism and aggression. And he did this in his fabulous painting of Judith and Holofernes. Now, many of you probably know this story. Holofernes was an Assyrian general who read a siege on a small town called Bethusalem, 500 BC, town right near Jerusalem. And after the siege had been in place for a month or so, the conditions in Bethlehem became impossible. Sanitary conditions were broken down. There was no food. People were in miserable shape. And Judith, a young widow, 26 years old, decided she would take it upon herself to save her people. She would seek out Holofernes. So she took a handmaiden. Two of them snuck through the troops that were causing the siege, and she found Holofernes, who was enjoying himself at a party, drinking French wines. And she encouraged him to drink more. He drank more. And after a while, she encouraged him to take her to his tent. And there, she seduced him. They had sex together. And exhausted by sex and drink, he fell asleep. She took the sword off the wall and cut off his head. This is repeatedly depicted in Western art, this modest widow sacrificing herself to save her people. This is not Klimt's Judith. She's in a post-coital trance. Her breast is exposed. Her eyes are still glossy from the sexuality of it all. And she's fondling the dead, isolated head of Holofernes in the corner of the painting. An absolutely remarkable painting. So he really had a very deep understanding of the richness and complexity of female sexuality. But I said that Rokitansky was a great driving force on these scientists. How did Rokitansky, who influenced Freud, how did he come to influence Klimt? Well, you obviously know it's through the Zuckerkandels. Emil Zuckerkandel was a great anatomist who is Rokitansky's right-hand person. They collaborated together on many things. And he was married to Bertha Zuckerkandel, and Bertha Zuckerkandel ran the best salon in Vienna. On my diva, Vienna comes alive. Anybody who was anybody wanted to be invited to her salon. She had business people, she had artists, she had writers, she had actors, she had scientists. And they all came, they all interacted with each other. Klimt came and he became fascinated with Zuckerkandel's anatomy. He went to his lectures, took notes, started to read. When he died, there were 4 volumes of Darwin in his book collection. How many of you have 4 volumes of Darwin in your book collection? Thank you very much. So he really became interested, and he began to look in the microscope and began to see what Zuckerkandel was looking at, cells and tissues and things like this, and began to focus in on sperm and on eggs and began to incorporate these images into his paintings. So if you look at this Zeus coming to Dan in a shower of raindrops, you see this shower of raindrops that Zeus spilled. And in it, if you look here, you see a rectangular symbol. If you look here, that's sperm. This is Klimt's symbol for sperm. If you look here, these oval structures, these are fertilized eggs. So here, Diana is a reproductive machine, if you will, converting sperm into fertilized ova. If you look at the very famous painting, The Kiss, you see the male is covered with these rectangular symbols, and the woman is covered with these circular ones. So now if you look at Klimt paintings, you often encounter these symbols. He incorporated biological symbols that he learned from Zuckerkandel into his work, very much influenced by biology. One of the wonderful things about Klimt is not only was he a great artist in his own right, but he was extremely generous to 2 younger colleagues. Excuse me. Kokoschka and Schiele, whom he did not train, who didn't work with him directly, but who were younger contemporaries, and he helped them enormously in their career. Kokoschka, for example, was the first Austrian expressionist. Klimt, if you look at his background, was very decorative, sort of an Art Nouveau artist. Kokoschka began to be influenced by Munch and Van Gogh and began to incorporate sort of naturalistic themes into his work. And he was concerned with three major themes. He was very much influenced by sort of Freudian psychology. They claimed he never read a word of Freud. He claimed, Kokoschka made lots of claims, he claimed that he discovered the unconscious independent of Freud. And he therefore had a tremendous interest in trying to go below the surface to understand people's psyche. He did this with himself. His self-depictions are amazingly honest. And he did this when he painted people. He said, if I paint you, I know what your life is going to be like for the next 20 years. I really have such deep insight into you. He also emphasized in his concern about emotion, the position of hands, because he thought hands as well as faces communicated emotion. And finally, he was one of the first artists to really emphasize child and adolescent sexuality. So I pointed out to you that Klimt was sort of an Art Nouveau artist. Again, look at the symbols, the sexual male sexual symbols on the outside, female sexual symbols on the inside. This is Adele Bloch-Bauer. We'll come back to this later on. But if you look at the background, you see how ornate it is. You look at Kokoschka's background. He uses arbitrary colors. He just wants to create a strong emotional background. And he's very honest about himself. Klimt never did a self-portrait. Kokoschka did several. And in the aftermath of his relationship with Alma Mahler, he continued to paint himself as he did when he was going with Alma Mahler. Alma Mahler, Mahler's widow, had a terrific influence on Kokoschka. His greatness really emerged while the two of them were living together. But he knew from the beginning that she was going to abandon him. You must have seen this in Basel. There's a very famous painting, The Tempest, in which she is sleeping in a little boat very comfortably, and he is a nervous wreck about to throw himself overboard because he's sure she's going to leave him, which of course she did. And you can see this now. This is after she left him. He's terribly worried. His fingertips are red. His face has red markings on it. He looks extremely uncomfortable. But this is a wonderfully expressionistic depiction of himself. As I told you before, Kokoschka had the feeling that if he studied anybody for any period of time, he could predict where their life is going to go. And he so impressed some of the people in his intellectual environment that Adolf Loos, the famous architect, said, look, Kokoschka, you're a great artist. I'm going to go to people and I'm going to say, look, let Kokoschka paint your portrait. You're a great physician. Let him paint your portrait. If you don't like it, I'll take it back. People agreed to this. So Auguste Ferrel, the great psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry, University of Zurich, agreed to have his portrait painted. Kokoschka did this, spent 2 weeks of the evenings after dinner painting him for an hour or two. And when he was finished, Ferrel looked at the painting, his family looked at the painting and said, you know, we don't like it. Loos took it back, sold it to somebody. Why didn't he like it? He said, look, the eyes are asymmetrical. And look at the hand. The right hand is limp, completely out of keeping with the left hand. It looks like this guy had a stroke. So Loos took the painting, as I said, within a couple of weeks sold it. 2 months later, Ferrel had this identical stroke. How this happened, we can't be sure of, but often, at least sometimes, people who later have a stroke have an ischemic episode earlier. There already is a narrowing of the arteries. They clamp down for a second, and you can see the clinical picture that will later evolve. But in addition, Kokoschka was the first artist to depict female adolescent nudes. Dürer did a self-portrait of himself as an adolescent, but there were no female adolescent nudes. And this wonderful painting that Kokoschka did of Lee, this is also the woman he deals with as an unconsummated relationship of In die Träume der Knabe, this, which he wrote both the poetry and the woodcuts. Some of you may know that. There's a woman he's very fond of, but never consumed a relationship with her. But what's even more amazing He realized, like Freud, that you can see aggression and sexuality in young kids. He painted the Stein children, wealthy Jewish family, and what he did was not depict, you know, happy kids, you know, playing, but they were really on the floor, struggling with each other and struggling with their feelings. The boy clearly wants to pull his sister closer to him, and he's got his arm, his hand around her arm, pulling her closer, and she's clenched her fist, ready to punch him if he gets too close. This image made a big impression on Ernst Gombrich, whom we're going to come to later on, the great art historian. He said he thought that Kokoschka was really the great portrait artist of his time. He said, about this painting, in the past, a child in a painting had to look pretty and contented. That is, this is the way people wanted their children depicted on paintings. Grown-ups did not want to know about the sorrows and agonies of childhood, and they resented it if this aspect of it was brought home to them in a portrait. But Kokoschka would not fall in with these demands of convention. We feel that he looked at these children with deep sympathy and compassion. He's caught their wistfulness and their dreaminess, the awkwardness of their movements and the disharmonies of their growing bodies. His work is all the more true for life for lacking conventional accuracy. And the third of the three artists is Egon Schiele, in some ways the most radical of the three. Schiele didn't simply focus on face and hands, but on the total body. He thought he needed the whole body to communicate his feeling states, and particularly his enormous existential anxiety. Simply to remind you, this is the period just before and during the First World War, and rampant anxiety ran through society. And he felt that he could depict this society and self and this anxiety in self-portraits, and he thought he could best do this in nudes. So even when he painted himself making love, both he and his partner looked like they're on the verge of a nervous breakdown. These are the anxieties of modern life. And many of his paintings are nudes. He, in 1 year, did 100 self-portraits. This is more than Beckmann or Rembrandt, people who systematically painted themselves at various phases of the life cycle. He did this in 1 year. And many of these were nude, and many of these were in absolutely shocking positions. For example, Klimt showed females masturbating. He thought we show males masturbating, so he used himself masturbating. Wasn't going to be outdone by Klimt. Let me then go on to the second phase, psychology and art, the beholder's share. This begins with an extraordinary art historian who's practically unheard of in the United States, and that is Alois Riegel. Riegel argued that art history is going to die unless it becomes more scientific. The science in order to relate itself to is psychology, and the problem it ought to focus on in psychology is how the viewer responds to a work of art, what Gombrich later called the beholder's share. What's the big deal? This is obvious. The painting is not complete until the artist has painted it and people look at it. No one had spelled this out, that one task for art historians is to understand how people respond to works of art. Don't just study the work of art in itself. Also study how the beholder responds to it. This challenge was taken up by two of his great disciples, Ernst Chris, whom I knew well and influenced me importantly, and Ernst Gombrich, who I knew only slightly. Ernst Chris said, when you and I look at the same portrait, same painting, if it's any good at all, there's enough ambiguity in the painting that you and I will respond to it differently. What does that mean? That is, each of us, in looking at the painting, see it differently because each of us is undergoing a slight creative act in our own right. So the mere act of looking at a painting is a creative act for the person looking at the painting. So the beholder is involved in a creative act that mirrors in a minor way the creative act of the artist. So the beholder recapitulates in a very modest way the creativity of the artist. A very important point. Gummidge was fascinated with this. He started to study sort of the biology of perception and began to realize that the brain is a creativity machine. He read Bishop Berkeley and learned about the inverse optics problem, and then he read Helmholtz. So what did he learn from that? He learned that when you look at somebody, for example, when I look at Terry, my retina does not see the Terry that I see and that you see. My retina only sees photons bouncing off a face. This is clearly by itself inadequate for me to restructure a face, yet I do it. She looks the same to me as she did an hour ago. She looks the same to me as she looks to all of you. So clearly there must be other source of information that my brain uses besides the photons bouncing off a face. And Helmholtz was the first one to suggest there are two other sources of information. Bottom up and top down. Bottom up. My brain was not born yesterday, even though I may have been born yesterday. My brain has evolved over a million years of evolution. And our visual system has developed ways of taking minimal clues and making maximum utility of it. It allows us to live in the world that we live using the clues that we have. So when I see a source of light, I immediately assume it's above because the sun is above. If I see a person much larger than another person, I assume they're closer to me than the other person. There are lots of built-in things. Most of the everyday visual experience is built into the visual system. So with minimal clues, the visual system can reconstruct it. That's called bottom-up processing. But in addition, we all have different life experiences. We learn different things. We know different things about art. And this also influences what we see. And that's called top-down processing. Top-down processing is how the learned experiences that are unique to me influence my perception of people, objects, and art. Bottom-up processing is something we all share, and it's the universal features of the visual system. Now, in order for the visual system to use this bottom-up processing and to make intelligent decisions about what's out there, it has to take guesses. But, you know, 98% of the time, it's correct. But it has to make guesses, and therefore it can be tricked. Look at this. You see here a clear black square. Do all of you see that black square? I just want to make sure that people in the back are seeing it. Can you see it? Raise your hand. All of you seeing it? You are making it up. It's not there. It's all in your head. What happens is that if I turn these white semicircles around, you see that if these are lined in an appropriate way, you fill in with your imagination because it ain't there, this black square. So this simply shows you how the bottom-up processing can be right 98% of the time, but in part it takes guesses that it, you know, work a large percentage of time, but you can be misled. So Chris and Gombrich sort of worked out a similar scheme saying, you know, we don't yet know the biology, but that's going to come. But the beholder's share really is a mental representation of perception, emotion, and empathy, and that needs to be taken into consideration. And that the brain mechanism underlying of the brain mechanism, perception, emotion, empathy, someday people will begin to delineate that. And what I want to end with is a very beginning. I don't want to deceive you into thinking we've solved the problem, the beholder share, in rigorous detail, but we have some interesting beginning. I just want to outline it for you. So the beholder share, this is just a simplistic diagram, another person's face, so there's an analysis of the facial contours, the facial details, the representation of the body in motion, arms, fans communicating, feeling. simulation like me, theory of mind, we not only see a painting or a person, but we try to understand that that person has a different mind than I have, different aspirations, different goals. That's called theory of mind. And that gives us psychological insight into other people. Now, we're beginning in all of these areas to have some preliminary insights, and I'm going to just show you some examples. Let me begin with an analysis of facial contours. Darwin, the greatest genius biology ever had, pointed out that faces are essential for social interactions. We recognize each other and even ourselves by means of our face, and we use faces to communicate emotion and to find a partner. When you're dealing with somebody in a collaborative effort, just by the way the person interacts with you, their facial expression, you know, is this effective collaboration or is this not going to work out? So a lot of trust is based upon facial expression. Moreover, the brain treats the face differently than any other object. Faces are particularly difficult for computers to recognize, yet the brain is enormously good at it. And we can recognize a line drawing of Rembrandt's self-portrait. So this is a line drawing. I don't know whether you can see it. And if anything, you can see it better. And if you make a cartoon out of it, if you exaggerate it, you respond even more powerfully to it. This is why cartoons are so effective, and I'll show you the biological basis for that. Exaggerations of a reality make the reality more powerful. Let me tell you why the brain treats faces differently than any other object. If I were to take this bottle of water and turn it upside down, I would spill the water, but you recognize the bottle. There's no difficulty recognizing this bottle or any object that I hold up. But this is not true for faces. So, for example, if I show you two images of the Mona Lisa, most of you will recognize this is Leonardo's Mona Lisa. You know exactly where in the Louvre it hangs. But you will not realize as you look at this that one of them is the Mona Lisa and the other is a distorted vision in which the eyes are dramatically distorted. And if you didn't know Mona Lisa, I could show you two pictures that are quite different and you wouldn't know that they're different or they're the same. So you have great difficulty looking at faces upside down, but no difficulty looking at other objects. So the brain really treats faces in a very special way. What is so special about the way the brain treats faces? Well, first of all, there's more area in the brain devoted to representation of the face than anything else in your life. This was first appreciated by Joachim Bademer, who was a neurologist, who discovered what we now call as prosopagnosia, face blindness. You all know that there are four lobes to your brain, frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal lobe. Occipital lobe is where visual information comes in. In this area of the temporal lobe, the colors are somewhat distorted, but it doesn't really matter. Have they all been distorted badly during the talk? I didn't notice. No, I would have seen it here. No. This area of the temporal lobe is where faces are represented. So this is the posterior inferior temporal cortex and the anterior inferior temporal cortex. If you have a lesion here, you don't recognize a face qua face. Oliver Sacks' famous story, the man who mistook his wife for a hat, is based on a person who has a lesion here. A woman takes her husband to see a physician. At the end of the interview, he gets up off his chair, tries to pick up his wife's head and put it on his head, thinking it's his hat. If you have a lesion here, you recognize a face qua face, but you have difficulty recognizing who it is. Chuck Close has prosopagnosia of this kind. Here is one of the great portrait artists of our time, and he's face blind. How do you do that? Well, he's very creative. He takes a picture of you before he paints your portrait. Puts the picture down, puts a piece of paper over it, translucent, and then draws all kinds of things on top of that to give it the characteristic design features of the face that is classic for a Chuck Close portrait. For some reason, the colors are changing. Can you help me a little bit? Well, I think it'll work, but it looks artificial, very artificial. Charles Gross was the first person to record from this area in monkeys, and he realized that some of the cells there respond to faces. Nancy Kanwisher picked up on this, and she did imaging experiments in people, and she realized that an area in this region, which she called the fusiform face area, responds to faces. Another region responds to houses. So she realized that there is a distribution of representation of objects in the brain. But more recently, Margaret Livingston and two of her students, Doris Sauer and Winfried Freiwald, combined this. They combined brain imaging with cellular recording. And when they did brain imaging, they noticed that when they showed a monkey a face, six patches lit up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, which they called the face patches. When they now recorded from these face patches, 95% of the cells respond to faces. If you stimulate the central patches, you light up all the other patches, indicating it's an interconnected system for processing faces. Some of these patches show the face from head on, some of them show from profile, some of them show both, so you're building up the structure of the face by being processed in this system. And a similar, although slightly reduced, machinery operates in the human brain as well. Let me show you what it's like to record from a single cell. So if you record from a single cell in a monkey, and you show the monkey a picture of the monkey, the cell goes, brrr, monkeys like pictures of monkeys. If you show a monkey a cartoon of a monkey, the cell goes even wilder, brrr, it likes cartoons even more than likes the real face. Notice that it doesn't require a nose. And it's probably because the nose does not participate in emotional expressions. The eyes and the mouth change a great deal, the nose very little. So if you move the mouse, no firing. If you move the eyes, no firing. Eyes, mouth, and no circle, no firing. Circle alone, no firing. You've got to have eyes, mouth, and a circle, and brrr, it fires. If you exaggerate by pulling the eyes further apart or closer together, the cells go wild. If you turn it upside down, what do you think happens? No response. Excellent. So I'm not going to take you through all of these other areas, but I would just want to get your feeling about this. That we have a beginning understanding of many of these other areas that are involved in the neural circuit of the beholder's share. So this is striate cortex. This is where visual information comes in. I showed you the inferior temporal cortex with this face representation. There's an area here called the lateral occipital cortex where visual and tactile interactions occur. Why is this important? When you stand in front of many paintings, Soutine is a perfect example. De Kooning is another example. The paint itself, Jackson Pollock, has a texture. And you have a desire to touch it. You feel a tactile sensation. Berenson first pointed out that many works of art, particularly with the thickness of the paint, also recruit tactile sensation. So that visual tactile interaction, this begins at this area. Then there's an area that is concerned with motion, with a body representation. There's an area that's concerned with motion, and the area that is concerned with biological motion. So the area that responds to motion responds to all kinds of motion, a car moving, a bicycle moving. The one that responds to biological motion responds to my reaching out my hand to grasp your hand. People with autism have no difficulty at all seeing a car move. But because they have difficulty with interpersonal interactions, they cannot respond to you reaching your hand out. They can't respond to looking you straight in the eye. They look down. When they look at portraits, for example, they never look the portrait in the eye. They always look below that. In addition, there are areas that are concerned with mirror neurons. This is Rizzolatti's major discovery. He found out that these areas in the monkey brain, and it turns out you have it also, respond when I pick up this bottle of water. That's no surprise. I pay this area to do that. That's its job. But the amazing thing is it responds when you pick up a bottle of water. So it responds, really, with anticipation of what you might do. It's a mirror neuron area. It responds, it mirrors your behavior. And we now think that this is not just true in action, this is probably also true in infant rearing. When a child learns language from its mother or father, it doesn't simply listen to the language and imitate that, but also looks at the movements of the mouth and sees the expressions that go with the articulation of words. And finally, there's an area that's concerned with theory of mind, and that is, and again, this is lacking in autistic kids, but most of us realize that every one of you out there has your own idea of where you want to go with your life, which is different from mine. And we all can appreciate that another person has their own identity, their own goal, their own sense of direction. But in addition to this, we know a fair amount about emotional aspect of this. We realize there's an area called the amygdala, which is the orchestrator of emotion, and it projects onto the hypothalamus, which is the executor of emotion. And then there's a modulatory system, which is mediated by dopamine, which is the modulator of emotion. Let me give you an example of how we have gained insights from this. And I think this is extremely profound because I think this explains why eroticism and aggression are so often fused and so readily fused. Recently, we've learned from David Anderson's work about the circuits in the ventral hypothalamus that control mating, eroticism, and that control aggression. He's found that in the ventromedial hypothalamus, there are two areas that are contiguous with one another. In fact, in between, there's a population of mixed neurons that respond both to mating and fighting. So there's some cells that are concerned with fighting, some cells with mating. They're right next to each other. And in between, there's a border zone in which cells can do one or the other depending upon intensity of stimulation. If you stimulate weakly, you get eroticism, foreplay. If you stimulate strongly, fighting. So you see what kinds of things that Freud, Klimt, and Sheely were talking about. We're beginning to see this in terms of the new science of mind. Although we don't know the details, but one of the reasons people can switch so easily from eroticism to aggression is you can get this easily screwed up with these cells in between. Let me conclude by asking, can science reveal something about the love of what? Ronald Lauder, when he was 8 years old, came to Vienna for the first time, and he saw this painting by Klimt of Adele Bloch-Bauer, and he felt wildly in love with it. He thought this is the modern Mona Lisa, this is modern womanhood, and he was dying to buy it. He comes from a very wealthy family, and not a chance in the world. The museum didn't want to part with it. So he came year after year looking at this thing. And, you know, not a chance. Became ambassador from the United States to Austria, lived in Vienna, saw the painting all the time. Nothing. So what does it do? The orbital frontal cortex got all excited. And the modulatory system of the brain, the dopaminergic system, was activated. Now, this acts on almost every part of the beholder's share, and dopamine gets recruited for primary rewards such as food, drink, and sex, for addiction, for romantic love, and love of art. Now, as most of you know who've experienced love, and I presume this everyone in the audience, when you're rejected by somebody, you like that person even more than before they rejected you. So this guy's getting rejected time and time again. The dopamine system is going wild. He is seeing this and he's just going out of his mind. The dopamine system is exploding. So when this came on the market, he would have paid not $130 million. He would have paid $135 million to buy the darn thing. So he bought it and now it's in New York. It's actually made a major impact on the museum. Many more people come just to see this painting. So let me conclude that E.O. Wilson said, the greatest enterprise for the human mind has been, always will be, to seek linkages between the sciences and the humanities. And the Viennese modernists were among the first to work toward establishing these linkages in art and science by focusing on the beholder share. And their pioneering attempt in this great enterprise, I'm sorry, I got Dallas wrong. Forgive me, what a terrible mistake. The Modern Art Museum, where the spirit of modernism is carried forward to this day. Thank you very much. I would be glad to take a few easy questions from you. Madam.
Have you taken a look at any of the works by Lucian Freud, and how do they fit into the way you've been thinking about the
Viennese? We discussed this earlier today.
Aha, so you were prepared.
Yes. I become bored with Lucian Freud. The early work, particularly when he describes his mother's illnesses in pain, is just marvelous. And for the first 100 nude bodies, you know, I can put up with it. But after you've seen, you know, 150 nude bodies already, enough. So I don't think he's in the same league with Bacon. How does Lucian Freud fit into this? Clearly, he's the grandson, I guess. Walter's father was an architect, went to Berlin. He clearly, although he denied any influence, he clearly was influenced by it a great deal. Yeah. Sir?
All of these thinkers and artists had likely read Goethe.
Everybody
had read Goethe.
And Schiller. Festgemauert in der Erde steht die Form des Lebens. Heute muss... Okay.
And I'm wondering to what extent Goethe's notion of
color
and sight affected or at least influenced not only these, but also Darwin.
There's no question Goethe is extraordinary. And one of the reasons the Germans think he's not only Shakespeare, but maybe even greater, is because he was also a great scientist, and his influence on color theory was profound. I think by the time these guys came along, Goethe had been incorporated by color theorists, and they were more influenced by contemporaries. But you're absolutely right. It's a brilliant insight. You're reading the wrong book. You know this stuff already. Sir?
Back to the more simple things. Facial recognition centers in the temporal lobe. You don't have to put electrodes on individual neurons to recognize that babies learn facial recognition fairly early. And I wonder, when you see that, what degree of plasticity exists in these areas? Or is the mechanism of facial recognition in the DNA of those and activated individual cells?
Absolutely brilliant. Newborn kids, essentially, can recognize faces. Extraordinary ability. An ability we lose to some degree with age. So, for example, you can put a young child, 1 or 2 years old, into a monkey colony, and the kid will learn how to recognize 100 different monkey faces. You put us in a monkey colony, we struggle to recognize the difference between 2 or 3 monkeys because they're so alien to us. So kids' ability to recognize faces is extraordinary. That's built into the brain. Almost a bit.
Now, you can't do it later on. Something has been turned off.
But that we're built in with certain capabilities that are inborn, and this is an extraordinary capability. Facial recognition. But you see how important it is to human life. I see you with your baseball cap. I recognize you. That's so important. Yeah, absolutely right. Yes?
If sexual attraction and sex in general is...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
If sexual behavior is central to human interaction with one another, is there any way to interact with portraiture without the brain dealing at all with sexual attraction?
I mean, your brain interacts with portraitures. The whole brain is going to interact with it.
Right.
So obviously you can be aroused and you can be turned off. All kinds of emotions can be elicited.
Right. Like in your lecture earlier, you were speaking about how sexual behavior and interaction kind of informs every behavior of the brain. So is there any form of portraiture that is completely pure from this sort of...
Very interesting. You have to come to my next talk. So I've recently become interested in abstract art. And obviously in abstract art, there's a lot of what I call top-down processing, because it leaves it all to your imagination. Now, you know, if you want to, you can see erotic images in, you know, Jackson Pollock, but most people don't see it. They see all kinds of other things. But you're absolutely right. In abstract work, you're much less likely to see that, unless you're just sexually preoccupied. Yes?
Are there any theories about why cartooning is so important to inside the facial recognition?
I think because in some ways what a successful cartoon does, let's say a cartoon of Nixon, is to take a feature of his and exaggerate it. And that makes it easier to recognize it because this is how you associate him. Yes?
Why do you say that the beholder's share is minimal rather than the creative act of looking?
I'm sorry? I did say the beholder's share is creative.
No, I mean as far as minimally creative. Why is it not as creative as the artist?
I only compared it to a degree of creativity compared to the work of art. I think somebody creating a great portrait exercises greater creativity than a person looking at that portrait. This is not to say that that beholder can, in another context, be fantastically creative. But insofar as they exercise their creativity in looking at a painting, I don't think it compares to that of the artist. It shares similarities. Let me tell you what the similarity is. I find, and I think every scientist in the audience probably find this, when I take the lousiest ideas and put them together in a quasi-original way, I feel very good. People get enormous pleasure, even out of very low-level creativity. And I think one of the reasons we enjoy looking at art is because it brings out this creative potential, and it's pleasurable. It's informative, but it's also pleasurable. Yeah. But I don't think it compares to that of the artist himself for that particular task. Yes?
I'm curious if there's been any studies that show whether or not there needs to be some sort of degree of abstraction to the art for there to be a larger response than something that's more realistic, like, you know, photography or making video or whatnot. Is there a similar response mechanism, or do you need that sort of creative element to abstract things and make it kind of your own?
I'm actually trying to do an empirical study that looks at this. With several colleagues, we're looking at the same artist painting a figurative image, transitional image, and an abstract image. You can do this with de Kooning, with Jackson Pollock, with Rothko. And to see whether or not you, for example, looking at those three, prefer one or the other. And then image you to see what's going on in your brain. So I think that's one way of seeing what are the kinds of things that appear. Different people probably will have different responses to that.
Are you seeing any, I mean, just curiosity, are you seeing any response?
We have just started to do this by asking questions about this.
Okay.
But people do enjoy abstract art. Yes. One of the reasons they enjoy abstract art is because it's more unstructured and allows more to the imagination. Yes. See, it's much more top-down processing than bottom-up processing.
When do you expect to complete that study?
I'm looking for financial support for that study. So you can help that happen very rapidly. I think it would take a couple of years. Yes?
I just returned from Denver. The Denver Art Museum had an exhibit there called Women of Abstract Expressionism. I don't know if you're familiar with that show. But
these are women painters of abstract expressionism?
Yeah, they were in the 60s. 50s in yes. that area?
Yes, sort of from 45 to 65, yes. Yes.
When you said talk about the tactile part of the brain, much of that work, I actually had a feeling I wanted to touch.
One extremely interesting example is Jackson Pollock was married to a woman who was a quite good artist.
She was in
yeah, and he treated her rather badly because he, you know, badly alcoholic and things like this. And after he died in this car accident, almost a suicide, she continued to maintain their home. I don't know whether you've ever seen it. It's in Sag Harbor on Long Island. It's really fantastic. You see the floor on which, you know, Jackson Pollock would spatter. And they don't have any of his actual works hanging there, but they have a number of her works. And you could see the quality of her painting really increased. And, you know, with time, after his death, she became a wonderful artist in her own right. Yeah, yeah.
She
gave an enormous amount to him. She really helped him a tremendous amount. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, I didn't know.
Yeah. Sir.
What did a blind person visual cortex fire when they're having a tactile experience with art?
That's a good question, and I'm sure there's an answer to that question. I'm not sure I can give you the answer to that question.
So,
I would think that that area would respond to tactile stimulation in a blind person, but I'm not sure. Sir.
What's the effect of certain drugs or alcohol on this process? Does that have any relevance to art?
Do you want to argue on that? I'm usually sober when I look at art. I usually have the drink after I've looked at the work of art.
I think it's going to depend on how the drug affects that individual person. So in how tolerant they are to the effects, it could dull the response, it could stimulate it. Dr. Kandel was talking about dopamine, and drugs of abuse will activate dopamine, so it could certainly heighten the response and make it more pleasurable. Certainly, if you use hallucinogens, it would change the experience markedly.
Yes, it's actually interesting. There are probably some artists that took hallucinogens. When I was a psychiatric resident, Ed Sacker, who was a year before us, had the crazy idea, which I did not go along with, that all psychiatric residents should try LSD because they would know what a psychotic episode was like. I said, I'll accept it on faith. I don't have to try. One last question. Sir.
Well, this may sound a little reductionist, but do you think that we will ultimately evolve to a point where basically art is a neurochemical transaction which will be able to analyze in a very fine-tuned, granular way as science and molecular biology evolve?
I'm sorry, he didn't hear the first part. You mean, will we understand the beholder's share in rigorous scientific detail?
Yeah, and also the other side of the equation, the creator's attitude. Because the creator is beholding something.
Oh, you're absolutely right. We certainly will learn more about that. We're learning now, not so much in neurobiological detail, but certainly from cognitive psychological point of view, there's a lot that's going on in creativity, really quite informative. For example, it turns out that a lot of creativity is unconscious. And people have now done experiments in which they see what kind of decisions are best made consciously and unconsciously. If you have to decide between two alternatives, you know, I'm going to get married, I'm not going to get married, then conscious is the best way to do it. But if you have to decide between, you know, one woman deciding between six men, that decision is best made unconsciously. So if you have to decide between many alternatives, you can't deal with that consciously. It's best done unconsciously. There's a lot of progress being made. In fact, my guess is that aspects of Freud will be interwoven into this because he realized that the unconscious was not uniform.
the different kinds of unconscious, and one is beginning to delineate this with much better and more reliable tools. So I think, I mean, it's an early stage, but I think within 50 or 60 years, there'll be an enormous progress in understanding this. I'll be with you in 1 second, sir. But the one thing I think I would emphasize very strongly, some people are worried that this factual information, this scientific, is going to decrease our enjoyment of art. And I think that's nonsense. If you know something about an artist, you know more about his background, does that decrease your enjoyment? Makes it more enjoyable for you? So I think these are completely synergistic. Sir?
Yes, sir. I'm a Vietnam veteran, diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm on a treatment program at the University of San Diego, University of California, San Diego. My psychiatrist was a brilliant artist. She did the artwork on the cover of the JAMA magazine, Journal of American Medicine, and made brilliant. She's a PhD in psychology and psychiatry. So I went to one of the sessions, and afterwards, we embraced, tagged, and then we separated, and we looked at each other. And I saw this circle of vibrating light going around her right eye. And then it shifted. It was red, circle. And then it shifted to her left eye. And there were these two vibrating, pulsating light circles projecting from her head. And then she stepped closer to me, and the light changed from red to blue, encircling both eyes. And just stared at her for a minute. I wondered what that was about. I wonder if it's possible to brain activity to manifest itself in the physical realm.
Well, I think, you know, you responding to post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a very frightening condition, may very well conjure up some, you know, perceptual distortion that entered into, you know, particularly parting with her, which must have been very painful since she was a very helpful therapist to you. It's completely understandable that you'd have a strong physiological response. Different people would have different responses.
Well, the military knows that post-traumatic stress disorder gets better with time. The symptoms sort of diminish after a while.
Then generally, that's the case, yes.
And this, I was diagnosed in the 70s, and I don't think that was a factor. I'm certain that I witnessed that her brain activity manifested itself before my very eyes in the form of a centric light circles.
Well, it's amazing what the brain can do for you.
Excuse me?
It's amazing what your brain can do for you. We all experience that. It can cause all kinds of distortion in our perception. That's, you know, not astonishing.
Yeah. Probably.
Well, thank you very much.